Let's pick up where we left off in the book of Leviticus. Actually, if you missed last week, you haven't missed anything. We just read a short psalm last week, so I just want to pick up this chapter 5. But just keep something in mind when we go through the book of Leviticus. It is a very, very difficult book. It's a book that most Christians shy away from. They stay away from because it seems on the surface to be very dry, very boring, very bland, very uninteresting. And it just doesn't seem to be a whole lot of spiritual meat there. But I really think if you approach this book with a different perspective and recognize that virtually everything in the book of Leviticus has symbolism to it, and the symbolism all points to Christ, either to his personages or to his work or to his love, to his sacrifice, to his death, to his resurrection, all these things point to him. And I think if we begin to pick up the clues along the way that this is how this points to Christ, and this is how this sacrifice points to Christ, this is how it points to his work, this is how it points to our sinfulness and so on and so forth, it begins to become a book that becomes very interesting, in my opinion. But you have to approach it from the understanding that it all prefigures Jesus Christ in one way, shape, or form or any other. Otherwise, it becomes a very dead, dull, and dying book. We left off in chapter 5 of Leviticus. It says, "And now if a person sins after he hears a public adjuration to testify, then he is a witness, whether he has seen or otherwise known. If he does not tell it, then he will bear his guilt. Or if a person touches any unclean thing, whether a carcass of an unclean beast or a carcass of an unclean cattle or a carcass of an unclean swarming things, though it is hidden from him, he is unclean, then he will be guilty. Or if he touches a human uncleanness or whatever sort of uncleanness may be with which he becomes unclean and it is hidden from him, then he becomes and it becomes known to him, he will be guilty. Or if a person swears thoughtlessly with his lips to do evil or to do good, in whatever matter of man may speak, though thoughtlessly with an oath, it is hidden from him, and then he comes to know it, he will be guilty in one of these. So it shall be when he becomes guilty in one of these that he shall confess that in which he has sinned. He shall also bring his guilt offering to the Lord for the sin which he has committed, a female from the flock and a lamb of a goat as a sin offering, so the priest shall make atonement on his behalf for his sin. But if he cannot afford a lamb, then he shall bring to the Lord his guilt offering for that which he has sinned, two turtle doves and two pigeons, one for a sin offering, the other for a burnt offering. Then he shall bring them to the priest, who shall offer first that which is for the sin offering, and shall nip its head at the front of its neck, but he shall not sever it. He shall also sprinkle some of the blood of the sin offering on the side of the altar, while the rest of the blood shall be drained out at the base of the altar. It is a sin offering. The second shall be then prepare a burnt offering according to the ordinances. So the priest shall make atonement on his behalf for his sin which he has committed, and it shall be forgiven him. And if his means are insufficient for two turtle doves or two young pigeons, then for his offering for that which he has sinned, he shall bring a tenth of an ephah of fine flour for a sin offering. He shall not put oil on it or place incense on it, for it is a sin offering. And he shall bring it to the priest, and the priest shall take his hand full of it as a memorial portion and offer it up in the smoke of the altar with the offerings of the Lord by fire. It is a sin offering. So the priest shall make atonement for him concerning the sins which he has committed from one of these, and it shall be forgiven him, and the rest shall become the priest like the grain offering. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, if a person acts unfaithful and sins unintentionally against the Lord's holy things, then he shall bring his guilt offering to the Lord, a ram without defect to the flock, according to the valuation of silver by shekel, in terms of the shekel of the sanctuary for a guilt offering, and he shall make a restitution for that which he has sinned against the holy thing, and shall add to it a fifth part of it, and give it to the priest, and the priest shall then make atonement for him with the ram and the guilt offering. It shall be forgiven him. Now if a person sins and does any of the things which the Lord has commanded him not to be done, though he was unaware, still he is guilty, and he shall bear his punishment. He is then to bring the priest a ram without defect from the flock according to your evaluation for a guilt offering, so the priest shall make atonement for him concerning his error which he has sinned unintentionally and did not know it, and it shall be forgiven him. It is a guilt offering. He is certainly guilty before the Lord." Okay, this is 19 verses. Like I said, if you read through it, it does seem kind of mundane, it seems kind of uninteresting, but let's just go through it really quickly. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but I want to just touch base on some of the spiritual principles that are set forth here. The first thing that God is saying is that now he's dealing with specific sins, okay? Interesting that the first type of sin that he deals with, because look, read this verse 1 in chapter 5. It says, now if a person sins after he hears a public adjuration, which is a solemn charge, to testify when he is a witness, whether he has seen or otherwise known, if he does not tell it, then he will bear his guilt. Now basically what he's saying here, I think it's interesting, it leads to the top of the list. It says, if a crime has been committed, and there's a call goes out and says, hey, if anybody knows anything about this crime, anything about this, whatever there might be, a murder, a rape, a robbery, or whatever, if you know who the guilty person is, come forward and testify against this person. And if you don't, then it's a sin of omission. It leads the list here. In other words, we do have an obligation to God and to our fellow man to you know, point the finger. You know, people might say, well, you just be a rat fink. But let me tell you something. If you know if a person's committed a crime, and of course, the more serious the crime, the greater the sin. If you know a person who's committed murder, or if, you know, maybe hit and run, or maybe robbed the person's house, or whatever the situation may be, I don't care whether it's arson, you can go through a whole litany of things, you know, and you know about it, and you just do nothing about it, this is a grave sin. And I do think that we have a moral obligation to stand up and be counted. Look what's happening in this country today, for example, when it comes to abortion. There's no doubt in my mind that if people would really recognize this for what it is, and they would stand up at a grassroots level and march on Washington and up on their public officials and really vote accordingly, then things could be turned around. But people are not doing anything. It's a sin. It's a sin. They're not doing what they need to be doing. That's why this whole country is going to hell in a handbasket, because people do not care. As far as God is concerned, hey, this is a grave sin and it needs to be dealt with. The sin of omission. That's what, to know to do good and not to do it. That James says is sin. And I think on Judgment Day, that's going to be one of the sins that's going to loom the largest. People think that they're good people because they don't go around blowing up banks and hijacking planes and raping and mutilating. But the thing is, what do we do? You know, Jesus said, I was hungry, I was thirsty, I was sick, I was naked, I was in prison, I was a stranger. What did you do for me? And I think we're going to be judged a great deal on what we failed to do when we had an opportunity to do it. And he said in verse 2, or if a person touches any unclean thing, whether a carcass of an unclean beast or a carcass of an unclean cattle or the carcass of unclean swarming things, though it is hidden from him, he is unclean, he will be guilty. Now, okay, we would look at this situation and say, well, you know, how is he guilty of what? But you see, here it is, the spiritual principle that we got to understand. What is God trying to tell these people? Read this again and look at what he's saying. If a person touches any unclean thing, whether a carcass of an unclean beast or the carcass of an unclean cattle or the carcass of unclean swarming things or insects, though it is hidden from him, he is unclean, then he will be guilty. You know, it's like even if he's not aware of it, okay? Let's just say he got up in the morning and went out to get his pet animal. He sees it laying there. He goes and touches it to recognize that the animal's dead. Well, you know, he didn't know it. He didn't do it intentionally, but now he's unclean. Well, God is trying to set forth a principle here. These animals have died, and anybody that touches them is susceptible to catching some kind of disease. Like I said, you've got to look at the spiritual significance of this, because death itself is a result of sin. It's because of sin that death entered the world, and even animals dies and everything dies. Now, God's saying this, if you slaughter an animal to eat it, that animal's not unclean because you killed it, okay? But if you stumble upon a dead animal, hey, that makes you unclean. That's why we have all kinds of laws in this country that prohibit, you know, people from taking roadkill and going in and butchering it up and selling it on a marketplace. Well, they do this in a lot of third world countries, you know what I mean? They'll find a dead animal on the road and they'll bring it in, cut it up and try to sell it on a marketplace. Well, everybody's going to get sick. How do you know what that animal died from? You know, what kind of disease it died from? See what I'm saying? Well, this is what the essence of sin is, okay? That these things that are unclean are defiling. And if you touch something that's unclean, it's going to defile you. But he's using animals here, but God was trying to point it in a symbolic way of what it deals with when it comes to the world. You dabble into, let's say, astrology. Okay, that's an unclean thing. You can get defiled by that. Or you can, like I said, you can mention 100,000 other things that can defile us. It makes us guilty. It makes us unclean. Even if we say, hey, you know, there's nothing wrong with this, you know, playing tarot cards or Ouija boards, stuff like that. Hey, it's going to defile you. and you're guilty of it even if you don't recognize it. Even if you don't believe it, that there's a spiritual power behind it, doesn't make any difference. He says in verse 3, or if he touches human uncleanness, or whatever sort of uncleanness may be, with which he becomes unclean, and it is hidden from him, then he comes to know it, he will be guilty. He's talking about any kind of human discharge you come in contact with, you know, it is unclean, and it's going to make you unclean. You know what the spiritual principle here is? Okay, that human nature is defiled. And it is defiling. Anything, I don't care how natural it is, that flows from human nature is defiled and defiling. If somebody, you know, accidentally sneezes in your face, what's your immediate response going to be? Huh? That is something that's come from, that's a discharge from another person. You know, well, 3,500 years ago, they may not have thought a whole lot about that. But we know today that this person is spreading some germs, right? Read this again. If he touches human uncleanness of whatever sort, like I said, if somebody sneezes on you, you become defiled. Okay, what's the spiritual significance of that? Again, he's trying to drive home the fact that, hey, you know, sin and ungodliness are highly contagious. And if we can contract all kinds of different diseases from each other, or sicknesses, or viruses, or illnesses, or colds, or whatever, the flu, when it's going around, one person gets it, you're more likely to get it. And the closer you are to that person, the better chance you have of getting that. If your kids get something, you're probably going to get it. You know, if their kids at school got it, their kids get it. You know, see how it all defiles us? That's the same principle that sin has in the world. It's that same thing. We're defiled, and we end up defiling other people. They defile other people. Everybody down the line is getting defiled, you know. And half the time, they don't even know it. They're carrying all these things, okay. But God's saying, "Hey, you are unclean, you know. Even if it's hidden to him, you're still unclean." And in verse 4, it says, "Or if a person swears thoughtlessly with his lips to do evil or to do good, and whatever manner man may speak, though thoughtlessly with an oath, it is hidden from him. Then he comes to know it. He will be guilty of these." In other words, what God is saying here is, it's a sin to make rash vows. In Ecclesiastes, Solomon mentions this. He says, "Guard your steps as you go into the house of God, and draw near to listen rather than to offer the sacrifice of fools, for they do not know what they are doing. Do not be hasty in word or impulsive in thought to bring up a matter in the presence of God, for God is in heaven and you are on earth. Therefore, let your words be few. For the dream comes through much effort, and the voice of a fool through many words. When you make a vow to God, do not be late in paying it, for he takes no delight in fools. Pay what you vow. It is better that you should not vow than you should vow and not pay." And, you know, you could apply this to a lot of different things, but I think one of the major things today is that when you look at the divorce statistics, you know, one out of every two marriages ended up in divorce. Well, how many people stand there before God in church and make these kind of vows, and then they don't keep the vow? Well, that here is a sin, and, you know, that needs to be dealt with. He says here in verse 5, "So it shall be when he becomes guilty of one of these things, he shall confess that which he has sinned." This is one of the first steps, is confession. If we confess our sins, he is faithful and just to forgive us of our sins. If we confess it, if we say that we have no sin, you know, then we call him a liar. And look at what's happening today. Sin has become outmoded. People are not using the word sin. If a person is steeped in sin, they say, well, the person's sick or the person has a disease. We've completely omitted the word sin out of our vocabulary, and God's calling it sin. In order to solve the problem, you've got to know the problem. If you're not going to owe up to the problem, then how are you going to solve the problem? And the problem is sin, so we've got to confess it. You know, if we don't confess our sin, how are we going to be forgiven of our sin? It's just going to go on and on and on. If somebody takes something out of your wallet, all right, and never returns it, never owes up to it, you may forgive them in your heart, but what's going to happen? You're never going to have that fellowship until that guy confesses it, asks forgiveness, makes restitution. Then you can get back to your friendship. He says in verse 6, he says, "He shall also bring his guilt offering to the Lord for his sin which he has committed, a female from the flock, a lamb or a goat as a sin offering. So the priest shall make atonement on his behalf of his sin." In other words, there has to be a confession of sin. Then there's a cleansing with the blood. Okay? That's how we get cleansed from our sin. This points to Jesus Christ. We look to Him. We confess our sin before Him. He cleanses us from all unrighteousness with His blood. It says here in verse 7, but if he cannot afford a lamb, then he shall bring to the Lord a guilt offering that and that which he has sinned, two turtle doves, two young pigeons, one for a sin offering, the other for a burnt offering. Now, this is kind of interesting. We were dealing with earlier the sin offering in one of the earlier chapters. And that these type of sin offerings, some of them are offered up on that altar. You know, before they offered up the entrails of the animal and they burn a carcass outside. But now some of these sins, sin offerings are offered up on that altar. And what they do here is if they can't afford, you know, a heftier sacrifice for your sin, if you really can't afford it, then you can bring two turtle doves, which are cheap, okay, or two pigeons. The priest, instead of cutting them open, he slits their throat and splatters the blood all over the side and then on the base of the altar. And then one of them is offered up as a sin offering, the other one's offered up as a burnt offering. In other words, you know, it shows that once the person confesses the sin, then there's that rededication. But again, there's that shedding of blood. When people went into the tabernacle area, that courtyard, and they saw that altar, I mean, it was just drenched with blood. It was blood all over the place. I mean, this is a thing that you saw. And it was like that God's constant reminder of them, without the shedding of blood, there's no forgiveness of sins. So God makes provision even for the poor. But now read on a little bit further, because this is even more interesting when he says this in verse 9. He shall also sprinkle some of the blood of the sin offering on the side of the altar, while the rest of the blood shall be drained out of the base of the altar. It is a sin offering. Verse 10, then the second he shall then prepare as a burnt offering according to the ordinance, so the priest shall make atonement on his behalf for the sin which he has committed, and it shall be forgiven him. Now, look what he says further, verse 11. But if his means are insufficient for two turtle doves or two young pigeons, then for his offering, for that which he has sinned, he shall bring a tenth of an ephah of fine flour for a sin offering, and he shall not put oil on it or place it on incense on it, for it is a sin offering, and he shall bring it to the priest, and the priest shall take his handful of it as a memorial portion and offer it up in the smoke on the altar with the offering of the Lord by fire. It is a sin offering. So the priest shall make atonement for him concerning his sin which he has committed for one of these. It shall be forgiven him. Then the rest shall become the priest like the grain offering. Okay, now here's a very interesting thing. We are told in scriptures time and time again that without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness of sin. But if a person was so dirt poor that they couldn't even afford two turtle doves, he says, okay, I'm still going to make provision for you. You can bring a small ff of flour, a tenth of an ff, whatever that was. It was probably the equivalent of a person's daily sustenance. In other words, the person would actually have to fast for a day in order to make this sacrifice. He'd have to go without eating. He was so poor that he'd have to give up his portion for his daily food to bring to the Lord. And the fact that they put it on the altar that was mingled with all the sin offerings or the animal sacrifices shows, in a sense, that, you know, it's still the shedding of blood is there. It's mingled with it. It's like when Jesus said this, "This is my body," and this, you know, when he broke the bread, mm-hmm. and he gave his disciples to eat of it, and then he said to as far as the cup was concerned, take this cup and drink from it. This is my blood. Interesting that in some of the churches you don't always have bread and wine. Sometimes you just have the bread. Well, the reason behind that, the theologians tell us, is because, hey, this is his body. In essence, the body has the blood. And the bread symbolizes the flesh of Christ, okay, because he's the bread of life. So you can't really separate the bread of life from blood. It's in the blood. But it's all symbolic, you see what I'm saying? That's why God has made this provision for the poorest of the poor, the least, the last, and the lost among men can still come before him and get forgiven, have atonement for their sins made. You see how God is so, he will reach to the uttermost to save the lost, the most lost among us. So he has made this kind of provision. And then he says, then the Lord spoke to Moses saying, if a person acts unfaithfully and sins unintentionally against the Lord's holy things, then he shall bring his guilt offering to the Lord, a ram without defect from the flock, according to your valuation in silver by shekels in terms of the shekel of the sanctuary for a guilt offering. He shall make restitution for that which he has sinned against the holy thing, and shall not, and shall add a fifth part of it and give it to the priest. And the priest shall then make atonement for him with the ram of the guilt offering, and it shall be forgiven him. Now, he's talking about sinning against the Lord, even unintentionally. And I think a way that you do that, you know, a way that you could do that, if you look at the book of Malachi, for example, in Malachi, in chapter 3, God basically chides his people when he says, well, man robbed God, yet you are robbing me, but you say, how have we robbed God? In other words, they didn't know they were robbing God. And God says, in tithes and contributions, you are cursed with a curse, for you are robbing me of the whole nation of you. Bring the whole tithe into the storehouse, so that there may be food in my house, and test me now on this, says the Lord of hosts, if I will not open for you the windows of heaven, and pour out for you a blessing until there is no more need. For this is an example of how a person can sin against God, even unintentionally. But what it's dealing with here is, okay, when you sin against God, whether it's a sacrilege or something, it's a very serious nature. So you bring a hefty sacrifice, which would be a ram, and you offer it up to God, and you ask for God's forgiveness for sinning against him. Every sin that man commits, in essence, is against God. Even David, when he committed adultery with Bathsheba, says, against you only have I sinned, in a sense that, you know, if we steal from our neighbor, well, yeah, we have stolen from our neighbor, but in essence, we've stolen from God, because that person is made in the image and likeness of God, and God owns everything, and they're stealing from him. You're sinning against him, okay? But this has to do with, sinning against God in matters of not honoring God the way he's supposed to be honored in their religious ceremonies, or their, you know. That's an interesting thing here. He says that you are to make restitution and add a fifth to it. And when we get into the next chapter, that's another thing that God will emphasize to his people, that if you want to get forgiven for your sin, you first have to make restitution. I'll get into that in just a second. Let's close this chapter with the 17 and 18. It says, now if a person sins and does any of these things which the Lord has commanded him not to be done, though he was unaware, still he is guilty, he shall bear his punishment. And you know, this is one of the laws of heaven. Ignorance is no excuse to the law. I mean, you know, we can't get before God and say, well, gee, I just didn't know, I wasn't aware. For one thing, you know, we may be ignorant of certain things, but, you know, God has made his truth known to us in many, many ways, okay, through the testimony of nature, through our own heart, through our consciences, through other means. And so God isn't going to accept ignorance as an excuse. And in verse 18 he says, and he is then to bring to the priest a ram without defect from the flock according to your valuation for a guilt offering, so the priest shall make an atonement for him concerning his error which he has sinned unintentionally and did not know it, and it shall be forgiven him. It is a guilt offering. He is certainly guilty before the Lord. And that's the one thing that we got to really take to heart, that, hey, you know, God doesn't overlook sin. God doesn't wink at sin. And God is not indifferent to sin. And I think we look around today and there's so many sins that men commit. Look at the sin of abortion, for example. I mentioned this earlier. Or even now the partial birth abortion. And there's people today say, well, it's the law of the land. So, you know, they think that they somehow in their mind equate this as being acceptable to God. How they can ever make that connection is beyond me. But, you know, God, as far as God is concerned, you are guilty. You're guilty of murder. I don't care. Your guilt is there. Even if you say, well, I don't believe that that's really a child. God's saying, hey, you're guilty. You know, it's a solemn thing, isn't it? Anybody have anything you want to add or share to that? Yeah.
I just thought it might be interesting for you to give a little overview. Where are we in the Bible here? This is being given to Moses, and where are the people of Israel? They're still in the wilderness, right?
Right, yeah.
Wandering around.
Yeah, right. Okay, well, yeah.
Who is this being given to?
It's given to Moses, and he's the one that's giving it to his people. Remember, when we went through the book of Exodus, God gave all the specifications of the dimensions of putting together the tabernacle. So, put it this way, the tabernacle has now been put together, and all of its trappings, the court's been put up, it's all set up. But now, he's giving the instructions for the sacrifices. So, in other words, this is going to be the priestly function of what the sacrifice is. The tabernacle's in place, everything's ready to go, but they got to have all the instructions that God wants them to have as far as the animal sacrifice. And remember, when we're reading this, again, keep in mind, this all prefigures Christ, it points to Christ, and our need for forgiveness, and our need to reconcile before God. Okay, that's where they're at. This was written like 3,500 years ago. This is 1,500 years before the birth of Christ. This is where God is dealing with Israel as they're wandering around in the desert, and giving them all these instructions. Okay?
And is this before they were told to enter the promised land?
Yeah, right, yeah.
Haven't fallen yet.
Right. No, because remember, when they got out of Egypt, they were in the desert over a year, where God was giving them all this instruction. They were putting together the tabernacle, and they were instituting the animal sacrifices. And after a year of training, Okay, and putting all this together, then God starts leading them to the promised land. So it's not like they've turned back yet, but they are going to, you know, as we read further on. See what I'm saying? Okay, let's quickly go through this chapter 6, and we're going to close early tonight. If anybody's worried about it, well, I'm going to just go quickly through it, okay? And verse 1 says, then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, when a person sins and acts unfaithfully against the Lord and deceives his companion in regards to a deposit or a security entrusted to him, or through robbery, or if he has extorted from his companion, or has found what was lost and lied about it and swore falsely, so that he sins in regards to any of these things, things a man may do, then it shall be when he sins and becomes guilty that he shall restore what he has took by robbery, or what he got by extortion, or the deposit which he has entrusted to him, or the lost thing which he has found, or anything about which he swore falsely, and he shall make restitution for it in full and add one-fifth more. He shall give it to the one to whom it belongs on the day that he presents his guilt offering. And he shall bring to the priest his guilt offering to the Lord, a ram from the flock without defect according to your evaluation for a guilt offering, and the priest shall make atonement for him before the Lord, and he shall be forgiven for any one of the things which he may have done to incur guilt. Now, here's a very, very profound spiritual principle that's being set forth here, and I think it's very, very important. First of all, he's saying this. If anybody steals from another person, I don't care if he steals by deceiving his companion and takes away something that's his and says, hey, I don't know anything about it. If he finds something that belongs to another person and he keeps it, he knows it belongs to somebody else, that's a sin. That's stealing from a person. You know, if he takes it by robbery or extortion, all of this is taking what belongs to another person. Okay? And God's saying it is sin. And you are going to have to pay a penalty if you don't get this cleared up. But before the sacrifice is offered, what must be done?
Restitution.
He has to make a restitution. This is so important. I mean, this is something we have to see. We have to recognize that this is what's all important, is restitution. Okay? Interesting thing. It says here, not only is he to make restitution, but what is he to do on top of that?
Add
a fifth of it. If a person stole $100 from another person, he has to pay them back $120. Mm-hmm. This is a principle that I really wish to heck our courts and our judicial system would put in practice today. Don't you? Okay, we're warehousing all of these people in prison. And what are they doing? They're lounging around, watching TV, you know, playing cards, smoking cigarettes. Mm-hmm. What are they doing? Okay, what they really need to be doing is making restitution to their victims. That's what needs to be done. You put these guys to work, and I don't care if you pay them a nickel an hour. Whatever it is that they've stolen from a person, they're going to be there for a long time making some kind of restitution to pay back. And once they do that, the chances are a lot slimmer that they're going to go back and repeat the same crime. You see, this is what God's economy is. Hey, if you've wronged a person, you make it up by not only restoring, but adding more to it, almost like interest. Right? When you do that, once you've done that, what does it show? It shows true remorse, true repentance. In other words, remember when Zacchaeus had climbed that tree, that sycamore tree, and Jesus was walking underneath it, and Jesus looked up and said, hey, Zacchaeus, come down today, I'm going to eat at your house. And so he goes to Zacchaeus' house, and Zacchaeus is so blown away by Christ entering his house. He said, Lord, if I've defrauded anybody, if I've wronged anybody, I'm going to pay them back fourfold. What did Jesus say after he said that?
Today, salvation is
come. Today, salvation has come to this household. Because, why? He said, man, if I've defrauded anybody, I'm going to pay them back. And I'm going to pay him back fourfold. I'm really going to... In other words, he had a change of heart that says, okay, I'm going to go back and make things right with the people that I have stolen from, the people that I have offended, people that I have wronged. It's not enough for people to say, well, God's forgiven me, and you know, so on. That's just absolutely asinine. You know, you pull out of this driveway and you crash into Caleb's car and pull out and say, oh, God, forgive me for being so reckless, and drive off. What did you fail to do? You know? Right? Yeah, you've left me with a big car repair bill.
Put a nice face on a note.
Right? Right? In other words, hey, you've got to, you know, make restitution to show you're really sorry. I mean, that's so elementary, isn't it? But look how far away we've got from the biblical principles that make so much common sense. in our society, doesn't it? This is where the rubber meets the road as far as forgiveness. And we're kidding ourselves if we think, well, I'm just going to take a sacrifice to God and ask God to forgive me and not return what you've stolen, not confess your guilt to your fellow man who you've wronged. Hey, God says, hey, forget it. Forget it. You're not going to receive forgiveness until you've made this up. You know, or made every effort, conceivable effort to change. You know? I mean, and there's some times that you can't. I know the thief on the cross, he didn't have time to go off that cross and make restitution and add a fifth to everything he stole from people. But his situation was different. You know, he was dying. He didn't have an opportunity to do it. But I guarantee you, if he came off that cross, he would have had to have done it. Jesus said, today thou shalt be with me in paradise, because he had a broken, contrite spirit and he asked for forgiveness and, you know, God forgave him. Okay, but if he had prolonged his life, he would have had to, you know, make restitution in order to make that forgiveness complete. You see, that's what's really profound about what's being set forth here in this sixth chapter of Leviticus. And then it says here in verse 8, then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, command Aaron and his son, saying, this is the law of the burnt offering. The burnt offering itself shall remain on the hearth of the altar all night until the morning, and the fire of the altar is to be kept burning on it. And the priest is to put on his linen robe, and he shall put on the undergarments next to his flesh, and he shall take up the ashes to which the fire reduces the burnt offering on the altar, and place them beside the altar. Then he shall take off his garments and put on the other garments to carry the ashes outside the camp to a clean place. And the fire on the altar shall be kept burning on it. It shall not go out, but the priest shall burn wood on it every morning, and he shall lay out the burnt offering on it, and offer up in smoke the fat portions of the peace offering on it. Fire shall be kept burning continually on the altar. It is not to go out. Now, this is the law of the... Okay, now, what he's saying here is he's giving him more instructions. I think it's very, very important. The altar itself, they would offer in the morning and in the evening a burnt offering. The burnt offering, remember, symbolized total, complete dedication to God. Everything of the burnt offering was offered up to God. The priest didn't get any portion of it. The offerer did not get any portion of it. What it symbolized was Christ's total dedication to his Father, but it also symbolized to us our need for dedication to God. And it was something that was to be burned in the morning and in the evening. It was supposed to burn all night long, showing this. Every day is to be a type of rededication to God. The morning prayer, the morning offering, in the sense that, you know, you offer yourself up to God that day, every morning and every night. And this burnt offering was to be consumed all night long, showing that we are to be committed to God, you know, in such a way that we love him heart, mind, soul, and strength, you know, not just some of the time, not just part of the time. It's not a situation where we just go to church on Sunday, okay, sit in a pew like a darn cabbage, and then listen to the sermon, and then walk out of there, and then do nothing with your walk with God until next week when you sit down again like a big dud and do nothing. You know, this is not what it's about. You can't go to church twice a year and think that this is going to get you over as far as your spiritual obligation before God, because every morning and every evening, this is a total dedication to God, that our lives will be dedicated to him. You know, constantly. The ashes what present what from this burnt offering? Any idea? The offerings actually, in a sense, represent the finished work of Christ. In a sense, they also represent the body of Christ. It was what's left of his total sacrifice that was on that cross, okay? It was taken off that cross and placed in a clean place. In other words, it was placed in the tomb of Arimathea, Joseph of Arimathea, remember? It was still a holy place. The ashes were holy, even though it was a sin offering. But it says here in verse 10, and the priest is to put on a linen robe, and he shall put on the undergarments next to his flesh, and he shall take up the ashes to which the fire reduces the burnt offering on the altar, and place them beside the altar, and he shall take off his garments and put on other garments and carry the ashes outside. So in other words, he had to put on his priestly robe to gather together the ashes. And it would seem like, well, why don't you put on your old grubby clothes to do that? But no, he wanted his priest's clothes put on, gather together all the ashes, and then change his clothes and bring it outside the camp and then place them in a clean place. To me, that's very significant because it tells us this. Whatever we do, however insignificant it may seem, if we're doing it for God, in other words, there's nothing, let's say, glamorous. There's nothing what the world would look at as being something that they would want to do if, when it comes to, let's say, taking care of an old invalid person. Okay, you do that day in and day out, but you're doing it out of love for God. What you're doing is difficult. It's mundane. It's boring. It's unrewarding in many respects. You're not getting any attention. You're not getting any praise. You're not getting any... It doesn't seem to be that significant, but you're doing it out of love for God. Well, you know, it is a small thing, but it's still doing it as a priest of God, representing man to God and God to man. And it still has spiritual significance in God's eyes, and it's still going to be viewed as that, because God, Jesus said, what you do to the least of my brethren, you do unto me. And you're basically washing the feet of an old lady day in and day out. Who recognizes that? Who cares? Who, you know, nobody's patting you on the back. It's not like being out in front of thousands of people in a stadium, you know, witnessing for Christ, or being on radio, or being on TV, making a big name for yourself. These all have their places. But even the most insignificant things that we do for God, you know, need to be done in that frame of mind, that we're doing it out of love for God. We're doing it as if it were Christ. Interesting thing is what happens. The priest would have to keep this fire going continually. So in other words, they had to have priests around the clock. Some of them had to have the night shift to keep this thing going. Because why? It shows, in a sense, that Christ is there, you know, for us at all times, all places. He's the advocate before the Father, in a sense that we can come before him anytime, any place, anywhere. The offerings, to, you know, is there pointing to that. Christ's total, complete sacrifice to his Father on our behalf. It's there, you know, for any of us, even in the darkest hours of the night. You don't have to say, oh gosh, you know, I can't pray, I can't look to God right now because he's not up. You know, I got to wait till morning, I got to wait till this, I got to wait till that. No, this points to the fact that he's always there, available for us because of what Christ had done for us on that cross. All right? But here's an interesting thing, too. It said the fire should never go out. But we read, I think it's chapter 9, it says when they finally got everything set up and they laid their first sacrifice on the altar, it says fire came down from God and consumed the sacrifice. In other words, the fire got started by God and the priests were to keep it going. Very symbolic, okay, that God ignited this fire, that this is God's initiative to man. In other words, this is God's way of saying, hey, this is the way that I provided for you to come to me to be saved. But how many men today say, well, hey, I got a better way. I'll do it my way. You hear that song, you know that song? I did it my way. How many people are singing that in hell? This is the only way that we can make it. So he says here, 14, he says, now this is the law of the grain offering. The sons of the Aaron shall present it before the Lord in front of the altar. Then one of them shall lift up from it a handful of fine flour for the grain offering, which is oil and all of its incense on the grain offering, and shall offer it up in smoke on the altar, a soothing aroma. It is a memorial offering to the Lord. And what is left of it Aaron and his sons are to eat. It shall be eaten as unleavened cakes in a holy place, and they are to eat it in the court of the tent of meeting. It shall not be baked with leaven. I have given it as their share of my offerings by fire. It is most holy, like the sin offering and the guilt offering. Every male among the sons of Aaron may eat it. It is a permanent ordinance throughout your generation from the offerings of fire to the Lord. Whoever touches them shall be consecrated. Now here's another interesting thing. He's talking about the grain offering. Again, the grain offering points to Christ as the bread of life. You had to take that grain and you had to crush it and pulverize it and smash it into fine flour. And then make it into this bread that you would put on the altar and offer to God. But God got a memorial portion of this fine flour, that they were to put God's portion. They had to put frankincense on it. They had to put salt on it, and they had to put oil on it. Oil representing the emblem of the Holy Spirit, and frankincense representing the prayers of the saints, and the salt representing, you know, that was arrest corruption, or that we are to salt the earth, you know, to make a difference. Okay, that goes up to God. But then the priest got the portion of the bread that they would put on the tabernacle, or the showbread. They put 12 loaves out there to representing the 12 tribes of Israel. God does not feed us in mass, so to speak. He does not save us in mass. He deals with us as individuals, and he makes provision for us as individuals. So this is what the grain offering symbolized. It represented, it pointed to. And the priests got their portion. But here's another interesting thing. We were talking earlier about how you can become defiled by uncleanliness of a human discharge. Well, everything that flows from human nature is both defiled and defiling. I don't care how natural it may be, right? But here's another interesting thing. The bread became holy. It became consecrated. And then whoever touched it became holy. So you almost see a reverse situation here, that even though sin and ungodliness are highly contagious, so is holiness. Holiness is contagious. I've said this 1,000 times, and I'll say it again. Show me your friends. Show me the type of people you hang around with, and I'll show you what type of people you are. You know, you want to hang around with drug addicts, you're going to become a drug addict. You want to hang around with the immoral, you're going to become immoral. You want to hang around with thieves and liars and whatnot, yeah, that's what you're going to become. But if you hang around with God, you hang around with godly people, it's going to have an effect upon you, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Hang around with real godly people. Remember when James and John, they were arrested because they're a witness of Christ, and then when they got out of prison, they were let go. It says in the book of Acts, they went to their own company. Says a lot about them, doesn't it? It doesn't tell us anything about you where you got to spend your time 8 hours in school or 8 hours on a job. That doesn't tell you much about you. It's when you get off that job or when you get out of school and where you go from there tells a lot about you. You know, if you go to the nearest bar, the nearest drug addict, the nearest prostitute, whatever, they don't tell you a lot about you. But if you go to your own company, you know, people who are committed to Christ, it says a lot about you because it's going to have enough uplifting effect, a spiritual effect upon you. Then he says in 19, then the Lord spoke to Moses saying, this is the offering which Aaron and his sons are to present to the Lord on the day when he is anointed, the tenth of an ephah of fine flour as a regular grain offering, half of it in the morning and half of it in the evening. And it shall be prepared with oil on a griddle, and when it is stirred, you shall bring it, and you shall present it to the grain offering and bake pieces as a soothing aroma to the Lord, and anoint it. Priest who will be in his place among his sons shall offer it. By a perpetual ordinance it shall be entirely offered up in smoke to the Lord. So every grain offering of the priest shall be burned entirely. It is not eaten. This is a different type of grain offering that he offers up in the morning and in the evening. I think that's what he said here. The half in the morning and half in the evening. That's to be offered up along with the whole offering, burnt offering. Because here again, it's offered up with that, offered up on the altar. Okay, this is God's portion. This is not to be eaten here, but this is something that they do every morning and evening. It's the bread, pointing to the fact that Jesus Christ is the bread of life. And again, you see that symbolism that all points to Christ. He is the living bread. He is the bread of life. He offered himself up to his Father. Okay, he gave himself totally and completely to his Father. And as a result, he became what? A bread of life for us. So again, it points to the work of Christ, the person of Christ, everything he's done for us. Then in verse 24 it says, Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to Aaron and his son, saying, this is the law of the sin offering. In the place where the burnt offering is slain, the sin offering shall be slain before the Lord. It is most holy. You can't have a sin offering or you can't have a burnt offering without a sin offering. So they're killed in the same place. In other words, there has to be a forgiveness of sin before there can be a total dedication to God. And verse 26, it says, then a priest who offers that for sin shall eat it, and it shall be eaten in the holy place in the court of the tent of meeting. Anyone who touches its flesh shall become consecrated. When any of its blood splashes on a garment in the holy place, you shall wash what it has splashed on. Also the earthenware vessel in which it was boiled shall be broken, and and if it is boiled in a bronze vessel, it shall be scoured and rinsed in water. Every male among the priests may eat of it. It is most holy. But no sin offering of the blood is brought into the tent of meeting to make atonement in the holy place shall be eaten. It shall be burned with fire. The sin, okay, what he's talking about here, that last verse, the sin offering where the blood of the animal was brought into the sanctuary and sprinkled either before the veil or sprinkled on the mercy seat. That offering you could not eat of. That would be totally consumed outside the camp except for the entrails. Okay? He's making a distinction here. Because that points to the total sacrificial sacrifice that Christ made on the cross that we might be forgiven. But then all these other sacrifices that they can eat of shows that the sins that we commit after we have been saved through that washing of the blood the first time, then what it shows here that, okay, there's a renewing process when we confess our sins after we've become Christian. If we fall, we stumble, we fail, we somewhere along, we confess to God, you know, he's forgiving us. It's not like we become born again all over again. He forgives us of our sins, but then we can sometimes eat of that sin offering because it shows that not only have we been forgiven, but we draw our strength and our sustenance from Christ as we go on as pilgrimage. And just a couple other things that, you know, he's talking about these various offerings and some of the offerings that were put into earthenware vessels and they were boiled He says here that the earthenware vessels, they were to break. They weren't to use again. Why would he break those while the metal vessels they could scour out and use again?
Because the earthen would soak up the
blood. Good. Good, because the earthen vessels very likely would, there would be part of the sacrifice that would be lodged within it. You couldn't get it totally out. So that was considered holy and couldn't be used again. Because, you know, Christ, isn't that what Paul says, that we carry unspeakable treasure within earthly vessels? Okay, well, Christ's earthly vessel carried that in himself. And so an earthen vessel could not be used over and over again because Christ's sacrifice was once and for all. Anybody have anything you want to add or share?
I